This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stacio. Many of us learn the basics of sex and sex ed, how we procreate, what parts may be where, and how to avoid contracting infections. But the science of sex goes well beyond those 2D images of the reproductive system. In recent decades, researchers have developed a deeper understanding of the interplay between our brain and our bodies, and they've learned a lot about the mechanics of sexual desire. Today, we are looking at the modern science of sex. It's part of our series, Embodied, Conversations about Sex, Relationships, and Your Health. We're going to speak later with two sex therapists and the acclaimed sex educator, Emily Nagoski. She's the author of the best-selling book, Come As You Are. But first, we are going to put our human sexuality in context. Karen Bondar joins us. She's a biologist and the author of Wild Sex, The Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we dive in, I'm going to state what may already be obvious at this point. Today's show does explore sex and pleasure. So if this is something you'd feel would prefer to check out later, feel free to download our podcast, stateofthings.org. You can also join our conversation by tweeting at us using the hashtag embodied. So, Karen, you've spent so much time looking at sex in the animal kingdom, and you say that we really need to think about it as much more than just putting A in B. Tell us about what we can learn about sex in the wild.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to think about with respect to sex. It's pretty much, you know, tied to every aspect of our lives, but every aspect of any animal's life. You know, it doesn't mean much to survive if you haven't reproduced. But if we dial that right back down to the gametes, the things that both males and females have, you know, the sperm versus the eggs, that sort of gives us a little bit of insight as to how it's going to go. Sperm is extremely abundant and very cheap. And eggs are much more limited, and they're very expensive. And so this really sets the scene for how sex proceeds across the animal kingdom, including in the human animal, I would say.
Well, there's such a wide spectrum. And I know, you know, things like Planet Earth and these documentary series give us a really interesting insight into the variety of sex. But tell us a bit about kind of the range and diversity and what we can learn from the broad strokes.
Yeah. So we have to consider that, you know, the joining of DNA is the main function of sex. That is to recombine the DNA in ways that keep our populations very diverse. And the vessels from which we do this, generally speaking, in any kind of mammalian form are going to be, you know, a thing that squirts out sperm and a thing that receives it. But, you know, in many cases in the invertebrate world or in other different kinds of animal systems, we'll see these same sperm and eggs, you know, maybe being broadcast out into the water. You know, when we think about pollen season, what is really pollen? Well, for the plant world, that's, you know, that's sex. So that's through the air. So there's lots of ways that animals get the job done. However, for, you know, pretty much most things, mammalian, and I suppose even the reptiles and birds, some of them have these sperm collecting and sperm giving pieces of their anatomy.
So there's sex for procreation, but there's also sex for pleasure, which is something we're going to get a lot more into later in the conversation as we talk about human sex and desire. But is there sex for pleasure in the animal kingdom?
Yeah, there absolutely is. So, you know, generally people think that sex in animals is merely for creating more offspring, but that's actually not the case at all. So pleasure is one of those things where we have to make some assumptions. We can't necessarily speak to animals in their own language, but we can take cues from their body language. We can observe things, especially in some of our closest relatives, like bonobos, for example. We can look at their facial expressions. We can look at some of the patterns of brain waves and things that happen. And we can, you know, look at these muscle contractions as we might expect to happen at an orgasm or something to that effect. And we can absolutely infer that pleasure is happening. Now, sex can happen for just, oh, yep, it feels good, especially in bonobos, that's the case. In a lot of animals, sex can happen for reasons as far as social glue, establishing dominance hierarchies. It certainly doesn't have to have anything to do with procreation necessarily, but does it have to do with pleasure? Well, that's another story, but a lot of the times we can certainly infer that it does.
Is there a correlation between which kind of animals get sex for pleasure and which don't, and the amount of time that they spend gestating or the amount of kids that they have, babies that they have?
Gosh, so as far as pleasure versus time of gestation, I think those two things are potentially separate. But what we do see is when we have animals that, for example, are pregnant for a long time, something like an elephant that's nearly pregnant for 2 years, it has this massive gestation time. Sex for something like an elephant is actually pretty awkward. You know, it's not the easiest thing to happen. So, you know, in an animal like that, I'm also thinking of giraffes, where it's, you know, it's a big deal for these large, you know, animals to basically just make it happen logistically. So we're going to see less sex in these kinds of animals, especially, of course, once a female is gestating. But, for example, in something like a dolphin, which is known to be hypersexual, these animals, you know, depending on the species, will have sex many, many times per hour, 24 hours a day. So we see sex in a lot of these cases for social glue. Male dolphins, and this is often, you know, with dolphins, it's often male-male sex that's happening. And these are very tight social groups of males that guard females or that work together as a cohort. And sex is a really important part of that. So because of their machinery, because these are mammals, they have this same reactive tissue in the penis and the vagina. We can assume that every female has something akin to a clitoris if it's a mammal, and so we can infer therefore that this must be pleasurable, at least in some cases.
You mentioned giraffes briefly, and I know that something close to 90% of observed sexual activity in giraffes is between two males. Talk about the homosexual or queer sexual relationships in the wild, and is that common?
Yeah, it's incredibly common. I'm really glad that you brought that up because as somebody who's literally written the book on sex across the animal kingdom, I have yet to come across a species that does not engage in some form of homosexual sex. And it occurs for all kinds of reasons. We can think of, first and foremost, practice. You know, juvenile animals will often practice, get used to doing these kinds of things. And of course, it's, I suppose, whoever is around, whether that's somebody of your same sex or not, in your little juvenile play cohort. As I mentioned before, social dominance is a big one. And so often, alpha males will have sex with all the females, of course, but all the males too. In some cases, it's as a way to say, look what I have the power to do, and you don't. In other cases, as I mentioned with the male dolphins, it's much more of a social glue. So it's less of a dominance thing, I'm dominant over you. It's more of a, hey, we're all on the same page together. Let's make sure we solidify our social bonds. And so, yeah, there's lots of biologically relevant reasons for it that have nothing to do with procreation, but have everything to do with the long-term effects and procreation indirectly, if you will.
I want you to talk a bit more about power, as you mentioned, because there's some really interesting examples in the animal kingdom of matriarchal animal groups and what their genitalia looks like, and kind of raising questions around what gives a male or female power in these societies. Talk about kind of elephants, hyenas.
I love this example because, you know, this is something I've observed for quite a while now, and that is this extremely strange genitalia in the elephant and hyena mammalian groups. The females have masculinized genitalia. They have penises. We call them pseudo-penises. And in the case of the hyena, they even have their labia fused externally as a pseudo-scrotum. And what has to happen in these animals is that the females have to basically inside out this appendage inside their body before a male will be able to insert his inside. And so the long story short there, it's impossible to force a female elephant or hyena to have sex. Rape is impossible. Biologists call this sexual coercion, but it's the same thing as rape, and that is, you know, sex that is non-consensual. Now, in both of these animal groups, to take it one step further, we see an entire matriarchal society. So it seems kind of like if you take the penis power away from a male, you actually take away all of the social power that he has, because sexually mature males are actually the lowest on the social scale in both of these cases. I find that just fascinating.
We don't have a lot of time left, but to help us transition to our next segment where we're going to be talking about pleasure and desire, I want you to share what we know about foreplay in the animal kingdom. There are some examples even of gift giving. Is that right? What do we know about flirtation and foreplay?
We know a lot, actually, and I love some of these stories, especially in our closest primate relatives, because we can really think about how we shape our behavior and how we do that similarly as our primate relatives do. Females will often test the temperament of a potential male, to see how he will be as a partner. But of course, there's also this notion of attraction, and we can absolutely see sometimes in primate populations when the sex is on, that sort of indescribable moment almost in our species where we know what's going to happen. And so foreplay is absolutely part of it. In certain cases, we have to remember that primates can be very diverse in their behavior, and humans are included in that. So we'll have interactions that can be loving, tender, and very flirtatious. For the purposes of fun. However, we can also see something that is completely the opposite of that, as we can with our species as well. So there's all kinds of ways we need to incorporate personality and certain couplings, specific couplings together in how sex is enjoyed in animals. We shouldn't necessarily think of all primates as being the same, as we wouldn't think that of humans either.
I wish we had more time, but we have to leave it there. Karen Bondar is a biologist and the author of Wild Sex, The Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom. Thank you so much, Karen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, acclaimed sex educator Emily Nagoski joins us. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Today, we continue our series Embodied. It's an exploration of science and sex today as part of a conversation about sex, relationships, and your health. Emily Nagoski is an acclaimed sex educator who's on a mission to break down some of the biggest misconceptions about what's going on down there. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller Come As You Are, the surprising new science that will transform your sex life. Emily, welcome to the show.
It's delightful to talk to you.
And as we've been saying throughout the show, we are talking about sex today. So if this is not the right time to listen to the show, please feel free to download our podcast later at stateofthings.org. You can also join our conversation live by tweeting at us. Use the hashtag embodied. So, Emily, we spoke in the last segment about all the different kinds of sex in the animal kingdom and all of the reasons why animals are having sex. How about for humans? What are the reasons that humans are having sex aside from reproduction?
The single most common reason why humans have sex is to bond and connect socially, to enjoy something pleasurable, kind of the way we enjoy meals together and we enjoy television shows together. When we share pleasurable experiences, it bonds us and strengthens our relationships.
So it's something that we all do, but something that we feel really uncomfortable talking about. And we've been doing this series, and each week we kind of have the same conversation, which brings us up against this question of, why is it that American culture is so silent around sex? What have you noticed about why we do or don't talk about it?
One of the most fascinating things for me is that people can be more comfortable having sex with someone than they are talking about sex with that exact same someone. And what I have found is that people carry a lot of fear that they're going to be judged as inadequate or weird or somehow abnormal or broken if they don't already know everything about sexuality, or if they ask for something or desire something that feels out of the ordinary.
You are a sex educator, but you also teach classes, and you tell a really kind of beautiful story about grading the final papers for your sexuality class and the most common theme that you saw emerge in your students' experience. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, I had 187 students in this class. It was really large, and it was a very rigorous class, lots of science. And at the end of it, the last question on my final exam was, just tell me one important thing you learned out of all of this science. And I thought they were going to say stuff like the evolutionary biology or attachment theory or arousal nonconcordance, some specific piece of science. And instead, out of 187 students, all women, more than half of them just wrote, I'm normal. I'm normal. Just because I'm different from other women doesn't mean I'm broken. I don't know how much time you spent grading final exams, but it's not usually like this. I was sitting in my office with tears in my eyes, feeling like something really important had happened, that feeling normal was essential for my students, and something about this science had granted them access to it.
Well, I want to get into the science that you outline in your book, Come As You Are, but quickly let's talk about language. You use the language men and women, and part of that is because there's not a lot of research into trans and genderqueer sexual functions. Is that right?
Yeah, the relationship between the trans and non-binary community and the scientific community is, I'm going to use the word, complicated. I very much believe that that's going to get better over the next decade, both as technology advances and as more trans and non-binary people become sex researchers. That's what happened around the 70s and 80s when more women became sex researchers. The way women are represented in sex research was revolutionized by their participation in the research as investigators. And I believe that that relationship is going to change. But in the meantime, when we're talking about sex research, we're almost exclusively talking about cisgender women and men.
So a lot of what we know is shaped by our culture and our contemporary cultural understandings. Take us back to the history of some of the first documented messaging around women's sexuality in particular.
Yeah, the oldest English language sex manual I can find is, it's called Aristotle's Masterpiece. It is neither by Aristotle nor Masterpiece, and it dates from, I believe, the 1500s. And I was astonished when I read it to find some of the same myths that I write about in Come As You Are, in particular the idea of arousal non-concordance. People used to believe that woman's orgasm was how she got pregnant. That is definitely not true. They also believe that an orgasm was inherently pleasurable, that if a person experiences pleasure, then they must have wanted what happened. And therefore, if you get pregnant, then you must have given consent. Somehow pregnancy is consent. And just a few years ago, we saw the conversation of women's bodies have a way to shut that whole thing down. This continuing myth that what a woman's body does somehow says more about what she wants and likes than she, the woman, does.
Break down that arousal non-concordance for us. So you're saying that having an erect penis doesn't necessarily mean a man is turned on, or a woman who has lubrication doesn't necessarily mean that she's turned on?
Yes, there is some correlation between what's going on with our genital blood flow and how we feel, but pleasure, desire, and sexual learning, arousal, they are three separable systems in our emotional brains. So you can have your body respond to something that's a sex-related stimulus, say, yes, something sex-related is going on, so let me send the blood flow down to the genitals. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the sex-related thing that's going on is wanted or liked. They are linked but separable systems. So just because a person with a penis may get an erection or struggle to get an erection one night with a partner, then wake up the very next morning with an erection when it's nothing but an inconvenience. The same goes for people with vulvas and vaginas. Just because they're lubricating doesn't mean they want or like what's happening.
So you mentioned Aristotle and looking at these pieces of medieval literature. And it's interesting because there are things that we, at least when I was reading your book, I thought of as very basic knowledge that no one could disagree with, such as the story of the hymen. Tell me about the hymen and what you've unlearned about it.
The hymen, for me, is a metaphor for everything in Come As You Are, because the biological truth about the hymen is that it has no reproductive function. It's a biological side effect extra of the cascade of organization that happens to our genitals in utero as we develop the shape of our genitals. It doesn't do anything. And yet, culturally, it has this whole story behind it. A patriarchal society saw a fold of tissue over the mouth of the vagina, and as my husband jokingly calls it, they saw a freshness seal that indicated whether or not this vagina was clean enough to be purchased when women's bodies were literal property traded from father to husband. when it turns out there's actually zero correlation between the size and shape of a hymen and whether or not that vagina has been penetrated. None. Women who have given birth have intact hymens.
So there's actually a bigger correlation between the people who are in power and how we understand our biology, it seems.
Absolutely. The main way that sex research was done for a long time was to look at how men work and assume that the way men work is the way people are all supposed to work, so that the ways women work, we turn out to be, you know, kind of like men, only a little broken all the time.
Well, that brings us to kind of new models that you are using to think differently about some of these pervasive myths. So tell me about your concern with the term sex drive and why you think it's not actually the most apt way to describe what's happening.
Yes. Oh, I love talking about this. The most basic reason why I don't like it is because it is not factually correct. A drive is a biological mechanism that's like an alert, an alarm system, flashing red lights, awooga, awooga, there's something wrong. There's a problem that pushes an organism out into the world to go solve that problem. Hunger can be a drive. Even sleep is a drive. Thirst, thermoregulation. If you don't meet these needs, what happens? You literally die. Sex is not one of those. What it is an incentive motivation system. Now, I do not believe that we're going to transition from saying sex drive to sexual incentive motivation
system.
Yeah,
that's not going to work.
But what it means is that sex is not analogous to hunger. It's analogous to curiosity. So instead of being an uncomfortable thing that happens inside your body to push you out into the world, it's a pleasurable sensation that happens that pulls you towards something out in the environment that feels desirable and interesting that you want to explore. Now, if someone steals bread because they're starving, we can kind of understand that. But if someone steals bread because they're really curious about somebody else's bread, we're less willing to just be like, well, you know what? He was really curious. Let's forgive him this time.
Well, so we're not going to die if we don't have sex, but there's such a variation in how much sex people want to have, what people's, you know, interest in sex is. How do you explain all that difference?
Oh, so one of my favorite pieces of science in the book is a thing called the dual control model. This is the mechanism in our brain that governs sexual response. Dual control model, it's got two parts. There's a sexual accelerator or gas pedal that notices all the sex-related information in the environment and it sends the turn-on signal. And then there's the brakes that notice all the good reasons not to be turned on right now, and it sends the turn-off signal. So the process of arousal, interest, desire is the dual process of turning on the ons and turning off all the offs. So our level of desire at any given moment is the balance of these two things. When people experience more sexual desire, it's because there's more stuff hitting the accelerator and less stuff hitting the brakes. And occasionally it's because a person has a very sensitive accelerator or insensitive accelerator or a very sensitive brake or a very insensitive brake. So a lot of the variability in people's experience of desire can be explained by understanding that it's a dual mechanism that controls sexual response.
Are there some things that are across the board ons and across the board offs, or is this all learned with each individual?
It looks like it's highly variable. So how do you do the sex research that finds out if there are any innate in place when we are born sexually related information that sends a turn-on signal? I don't know how you do that study ethically. So we're sort of guessing. But it looks like we're not so much born with knowing what's going to be sex-related as it is that we learn to link together what we notice in the environment, what sort of internal sensations we have, and what's going on with our physiological response. And that process teaches us how to feel about the sexual world and our sexual bodies.
So there's kind of this common myth that desire is spontaneous, and there are certain things that are going to automatically arouse all of us, and that is the kind of first step in a sexual encounter. But you say that's not true, and especially for women, this idea of spontaneous desire is really not actually very common.
Exactly. Spontaneous desire is one healthy, normal way to experience sexual desire. Erica Mowen, the cartoonist who illustrated Come As You Are, draws spontaneous desire as a lightning bolt to the genitals. Kaboom! You just want it out of the blue. And that's one normal way to experience desire. But what's more common, if spontaneous desire emerges in anticipation of pleasure, responsive desire emerges in response to pleasure. So what this looks like very often, say in a couple in a long-term relationship with some kids, you arrange childcare, you put the last of the dishes in the dishwasher, you tromp up the stairs, it's Saturday at 3 o'clock, you, me, in the underwear, like we said, you put your body in the bed, you let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body goes, oh, right, I like this. I like this person. And just because you weren't thrilled and like craving the sex before you got there doesn't mean it isn't a delightful, totally healthy, normal sexual experience. The way I boil this down is to say that pleasure is the measure of sexual response, sexual experiences. It's not how much you crave it, how often you do it, where you do it, who you do it with, what positions. It's whether or not you like the sex that you have.
So if pleasure is not the end-all be-all, how does orgasm fit into the picture? Because you said at the top of the show that you don't even
include... Oh, pleasure is the end-all be-all.
Well, okay.
Orgasm is only one of the ways.
Okay, so then tell me about kind of unlinking pleasure and orgasm.
Yeah, so remember, arousal non-concordance, just because your genitals are doing something in response to a sex-related stimulus doesn't mean that it's pleasurable all the time. I know that the standard narrative about orgasm is that it's a peak of sexual pleasure, but really it's just one of the ways that we can experience sexual pleasure. There are some women who never experience orgasm and can experience massive sexual pleasure. There are some days when orgasm is just too much work. But you can enjoy the heck out of a whole lot of sexual connection and pleasure and doing a lot of other things. You can even get a lot of sexual pleasure out of enjoying what your partner's experiencing. And when we have orgasm is like, I have to have an orgasm, say in a heterosexual couple, where he feels like he has to give her an orgasm in order to be a man and successful, that's a great way to create a dynamic where she feels pressured to perform, which of course hits the brakes and makes it more difficult to have an orgasm, which means that she's going to be motivated to fake it.
What's going on right now in the science of sex that is intriguing for you? And maybe I can kind of point you to one thing before we dig deep into that, which is this question of female Viagra and this push for that. Talk to me about that and your thoughts on the research.
Yeah, it's been 20 years now, ever since Viagra came on the market, they've been looking for an equivalent drug for women, and that has really become focused on a sexual desire drug. Now, given what I just said about responsive desire and how it's not about desire and craving for sex, if everyone knew that, there would be no market for a desire drug because everyone would already know that pleasure is what matters, and so we don't need a desire drug. Back when flibanserin was undergoing the approval process, we heard stories from women who were experiencing what they felt was low desire. They had previously experienced spontaneous desire. 10 or 20 years into their relationship, they were experiencing responsive desire, and they really believed that the transition from spontaneous to responsive meant they were broken. And believing you are broken, Does that hit the sexual accelerator?
It sounds like a break.
Totally hits the brakes. Believing you are broken means that you become the diagnosed partner in a relationship and you both search for the thing that's going to fix you and make you have the spontaneous desire again. And the more things you try, the more things fail, the more broken you feel, the worse your sex life becomes. If instead you can recognize that it's not the spontaneous craving that matters, but whether or not you enjoy the sex you're having, everything shifts. There's a great sex therapist and researcher named Peggy Kleinplatz who asks her clients the question, what kind of sex is worth wanting? And even goes so far as to tell her clients, you know, if I were having the kind of sex you're having, I wouldn't want it either.
How about porn? Does it shape our brains and shape our understanding or experience of pleasure and sex?
This is another place where it's difficult to get funding for research, so our understanding is very initial. The close as I can come to an actual science-based answer is to say that it looks like there might be a small subpopulation of people whose brains are extra sensitive to sex-related stimuli that might get trained onto it. It's a kind of proneness in the same way that some people might be prone to either obsessive-compulsive disorder or to drug abuse. It's unclear which of those it's more like. So not everybody is at risk for having a sort of problematic relationship with sexually explicit media. Most people can have a healthy relationship with porn. Most of the time when people struggle, it's not because there's something about porn inherently that's dysfunctional. It's because they find themselves turning toward that as an alternative to dealing directly with the difficulties in their relationship or trying to find a relationship or connecting with people or dealing with your, the technical term is negative affect, your stress, your depression, your anxiety, your loneliness, your repressed rage. We've all got it. You don't know how to deal with those feelings, and so you escape into porn.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but you said at the top of the show that we don't talk a lot about sex. We're more comfortable having it than talking about it. What's the value, do you think, in talking about it more and studying it more and understanding it more?
The more we study and understand sexuality, the more we create space for understanding that everyone is normal, which means that they belong in the human community, which takes away all of our excuses for being cruel or excluding anyone.
Emily Nagoski is a sex educator and the author of the New York Times bestseller Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. She'll stay with us as we continue our conversation just ahead on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stacio. It's Embodied Today, our series about sex, relationships, and your health. Emily Nagoski is still with us. She's a sex educator and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. And I want to bring in two more guests to the conversation now. Lori Watson is a certified sex therapist with practices in Raleigh and Greensboro. She's also the co-host of the podcast Foreplay, Radio Sex Therapy. Lori, welcome.
Thank you.
And Tia Evans is also with us. She's a Hickory-based certified sex therapist and a licensed clinical social worker. Tia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lori, first off, let's clarify, what does a sex therapist do? What's your job?
So a sex therapist is really a psychotherapist first. It's all talk therapy. But we talk with people about their intimate relationships primarily, usually helping two people, a couple, figure out how to reach each other sexually, sometimes with technique, but oftentimes just with the dynamic of a sexual relationship.
Tia, tell us about who comes into your office. What's the diversity of clientele and experiences that you see?
So typically it is couples, but there are individuals that come to do the work and take it back home to their partners.
One of the questions that we got on social media when we were asking about this show that a lot of people were curious about is this question of sort of around what's normal, but people wanted to know, how often are people having sex? Married, unmarried? Does it make a difference? How would you answer that, Lori?
That is the question of the day, isn't it? I would say that on average, people talk about having sex about twice a week.
And are we saying, when we say sex, are we saying intercourse or?
Well, it depends, right? If it's a heterosexual couple, yes, oftentimes. But sometimes it may be a quickie and, you know, during the weekday, and sometimes a time that is really longer and more pleasurable, particularly for the female partner on the weekends.
Emily, for you, is this question of frequency something that interests you as a sex researcher? Do you think it's relevant?
It's a question I get asked maybe more often than any other. And from a scientific point of view, it's a really fascinating question. But from an educational point of view, it's impossible to hear the statistical answer and not compare it with your own sex life.
That's so true.
But really, does other people's sex life have anything to do with your relationship and your sex life? It doesn't. And yet we always compare ourselves with other people.
Tia, I want to continue the conversation that we started in the last segment about porn. Can you talk a bit about how you're seeing porn impact the experiences of your clients, especially African-American women?
So what we see more in porn is with African-American women, it's more aggressive, more kinkier type porn. So with this, it often gets internalized that our bodies are made for consumption in any way necessary. And I think that breaks down to how somebody might see themselves when they're trying to build normal, natural relationships with others. So it really can be a struggle.
How about for you, Lori?
Yeah, I think that porn is not real sex. Even the sex that is touted as, this is natural, real people having sex, those are exhibitionist people having sex that are willing to put it on online in some way. So I think the problems are frequently that it shows intercourse as the way that women have orgasms. That is generally not true for most women. It shows all kinds of things in terms of always being wanting, coming to the moment with a great big Shazam desire, like Emily talked about. And most women often come to the moment kind of at a flatline place, wanting to want sex, but not necessarily having, a lot of innate sensation and drive at that moment.
I want to talk about kind of this idea that we've been circling around, which is how we relate to our own bodies and how the story of our own bodies may impact our experience of sex. Emily, I know you talk about kind of body image and your narrative about your body as being something that could be in the accelerator-decelerator model. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, if you feel critical of your body or in any way unsafe in your body, that's definitely going to hit the brakes. And we know from the research that there's a close connection between body self-image and overall sexual health, not just sexual pleasure, but also willingness to use contraceptives and to prevent STIs and even be more comfortable communicating about sex and giving and receiving or denying consent. A person's relationship with their own body is the foundation of their sexual relationship with other people.
How does trauma come into the picture, Lori? Maybe sexual trauma or other kinds of physical trauma in particular, mm-hmm. And how that impacts how people present their concerns around sex to you?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I think that, one of the things that we do in our work is often as a couple comes together or an individual in sex therapy begins to explore their sexual feelings and ideas, sometimes what will emerge as a sudden block is the repression of a memory that happened in childhood or perhaps they've always known it. It wasn't actually repressed, but sexual molestation or being taken advantage of, earlier in their life emerges. Certainly, a young adult or an adult experience of having been violated in some way is often, a huge break, as Emily says.
So what do you do in that situation? Because there is this idea that, I should be able to return back to normal, and there is a normal to get to. How do you coach around this?
Yeah. I think there is healing that can happen and free a person to stop having recurrent memories like flashbacks. That's really a post-traumatic stress sort of reaction to something that has been in their past. And so I think absolutely people can become free from that. And what we do often is help them with their partner gain permission. Okay, if a memory comes forward or you have a feeling in your body that suddenly reminds you in a bad way about something, stop the sexual experience, tell your partner. We coach them to do kind of head to heart so that the person who has been traumatized puts their head on their partner's chest. And that heartbeat experience is very grounding. And they can often, comfort each other and maybe continue the sexual experience in that moment or maybe wait until another time. But that reduces the fear of having sex when you've had trauma.
Tia, how about for you? And maybe looking into this question of shame, a lot of us can learn narratives around sex that are filled with shame, whether it be via religion, via how we were taught to think about our own sexual orientation, sexual preferences, and that may impact how we experience sex.
So I agree. And I think it makes a difference with how a person is raised as a child and how they are taught sex and their bodies and what is acceptable and what's not. And as people progress and get older, even though they're exposed to different things, those root issues that they were brought up on still come out. And because of that, you see a lot of repression or a lot of guilt around wanting to explore new things or to even have pleasure in sex because of what has been taught that's stuck in their brains.
Are there any particular narratives around shame that come up frequently for your clients?
The biggest one is for Christian-based or most religious-based is the concept that you need to save yourself for marriage. And then when that doesn't happen and it comes out, especially like when purity rings and it doesn't come out that they were having sex before marriage, it spins around where why am I doing this? Why should I be enjoying this when I know this is not right?
Emily, yeah, as Tia mentioned, I mean, we're in the South and there are, you know, purity rings and purity culture, and abstinence-only education has been a part of a lot of people's learning about their sexuality. What have you learned about how that can impact sexual experience?
Well, the research on sex education is unambiguous and has been for about 40 years. We know that comprehensive sex education helps to prevent STIs, prevent unwanted pregnancy, and even delay sexual debut, the first time a person has sex, a very questionable term, which are the outcomes that people are looking for from abstinence-only education, whereas abstinence-only education is correlated with the opposite, increased rates of STIs because people don't know how to use condoms, unwanted pregnancy, and actually earlier sexual debut because people don't have communication skills around sexuality of setting limits and boundaries.
We spoke earlier in our very first segment about sex in the animal kingdom and the wide range of sexual experiences people have. And one thing we didn't get to that I'm curious to ask all of you about is sexual monogamy and kind of our cultural assumptions that that is the norm and our feelings about when that doesn't happen, what that means about us or our partners. And maybe a good kind of way into that, Lori, is the question of infidelity. And how does that show up in your office as people are, you know, experiencing sex outside of just a monogamous interaction?
Right. So there are various agreements that people make about their sexual relationship and how exclusive or inclusive it will be to each other. And I come from attachment theory, so I believe there's something about the desire that most people experience to be the one and only for the other. And so that is oftentimes why most people make the commitment toward monogamy. Infidelity is actually a lack of an agreement about how they are going to participate in extra relationships. So many times we have people come in, they call in, and it's a crisis because it's a violation of what at least one person believes they've negotiated in the partnership.
Tia, what do you do in that situation?
So I talk about the history, what got them to that point, and what would be the consequences if it happens again. I'm such an advocate for consensual non-monogamy. So if this is going to be a repeat thing, then let's talk about maybe opening up the relationship and what that might look like.
Is this becoming more common, Emily? Do we know? Is there research around the kinds and frequency of kinds of sexual partnerships people are in?
I don't actually know if there's research about how common it is. I do know that the way people perceive polyamory, consensual non-monogamy, is very different from the lived experience of folks who do it. When you talk to polyamorous folks, they describe a lot of calendar management and a lot of sitting around talking about everybody's feelings. Like, it's not a hot and heavy festival of sexuality. It's people being really grown up and taking care of each other, not just sexually, but also emotionally, and taking everyone's feelings into account. It's hard work.
Well, this brings me to an interesting question, because Esther Perel has gotten a lot of press recently. She's a sex therapist who does a lot of TED Talks. She has a podcast. And one of the things she talks a lot about is kind of, as our construction of partnership has changed, we're putting so much more on our partner. We expect them to be our sexual partner, our romantic partner, our life partner, our budget partner, our processing everything partner. And this expectation is a lot for people and can really factor into our sex life and how we perceive of that. Lori, for you, does Esther Perel's kind of theory resonate? And how do you see that in your work?
I mean, Esther Perel is brilliant, and she does work in some ways also from attachment theory. However, I think we have some differences about how separate people need to be and how connected people need to be. I think that the research, in my opinion, shows that secure attachment is actually the bedrock of optimal sex. So what that means in secure attachment is not fusion, which I think Esther Perel really hits well in terms of people thinking you have to be just like me in order for me to feel securely attached to you. But secure attachment actually leaves a lot of room for individuality and separateness. We have breathing room when we feel secure, right? I know I'm attached to you, so now I can go off and fulfill my purpose in life and bring that interest back. And within that kind of a relationship, sex flourishes. So I think that what she talks about in terms of this desire that we have for our partner to be all fulfilling to us is, you know, really a burden in life to expect our partner to be best friend, lover, and everything else. And I think that the idea of having some air to breathe allows us to have friendships and fulfillment in our purpose, in our work, and that becomes a more exciting partnership, right? It is difficult to think of your partner as having absolutely everything and then be so disappointed when they don't provide the perfect budget person, you know, friendship, everything else. And then that squashes sex.
Well, when we talk about attachment, I know many of us are very attached to our phones and our technological
Indeed.
Devices.
Indeed.
Is this becoming an interruption in our ability to create intimate bonds?
Well, I think that absolutely it's a huge distraction, right? Just go into any restaurant and see couples sitting together and looking at their phones instead of at each other. So it's a brand new difficulty that we're facing as our culture in terms of an interrupter in relationship.
Tia, for you, how do you see technology play out in the sexual relationships of the couples that you're working with?
So now you see all these dating apps that are right there on your phone, and that leads to people being able to swipe left or swipe right for hookups versus actually building relationships. And it's kind of hard to go backwards when you are in a hookup and then trying to develop a relationship. Well, you've already got what you wanted, so now I'm trying to figure out what this person actually likes to eat for dinner. That creates an issue, and now there's a struggle to build solid relationships due to easy access from your phone and from your apps.
If you had one take-home message, Emily, for our listeners who may have their minds blown by all of this new biology and science, what would that be?
Oh, gosh. What we know from the research is that couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over multiple decades are not necessarily the ones who constantly crave sex or who have wild, adventurous sex. They are the couples who first have a strong friendship at the foundation of their relationship. They really trust each other. And second, they prioritize sex. They decide that it matters, that they cordon off time from all the other things they could be doing, the kids they need to raise and the jobs they need to go to and other family members, or God forbid, they just want to watch some television. They stop doing everything else and just spend this time focused on each other's pleasure.
Emily Nagoski is a sex educator and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Come As You Are. Her newest book is Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. Lori Watson is a certified sex therapist with practices in Raleigh and Greensboro. She's also the co-host of the podcast Foreplay, Radio Sex Therapy. And Tia Evans is a Hickory-based certified sex therapist and licensed clinical social worker. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for The State of Things Today, a program produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is the technical director. I'm Anita Rao. You've been listening to a broadcast service from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.